able to recognize some tags, but I guess to a lot of outsiders, people just walking, most people walking on the street are not going to recognize them. What's kind of the aesthetic there that
In graffiti, each individual artist has his own, his or her own style. I mean, and you can pretty much tell where the artist is from just by his style of painting. You know, it's certain way, the way they write, the certain way they fill in or outline things, you can tell whether they're from Queens, Brooklyn, or you can even tell if they're from Europe. You know, you can tell a German style as opposed to a style from the United States. You know, in Germany, they use more like three-dimensional, no outline type of style, whereas opposed to here, they outline stuff and it's more flat. Like,
yeah, well, again, graffiti, like, I guess you can look at it as an art form of calligraphy. Because one of the things that we try to do is, the way you can tell everyone's individual style is that the way he would create an A is his own personal way of distorting what's the norm. So, you know, the way I would, create an A would be, you know, my rendition of. So it sort of becomes my little trademark, and that would become his, and then the next person would have their own. So it's sort of like a form of a stylized calligraphy or something like that, so. Okay. Right.
I mean, it does exist. I mean, I'm not saying that doesn't. It does, but What happens is, it's funny because whenever you hear of graffiti or anything, it's always in the media, it's always gang related or in a negative light. So you're never ever exposed to the positive side of graffiti. Right. I mean, I'll give you
a
situation.
Which is what I was saying about everyone being clumped together in like one
big category. We went to do a lecture, and we opened up our portfolio, and we had, you know, 100-foot murals and large-scale murals, and we show it to this woman. And she goes to her friend, she goes, oh, look at all the gang graffiti, look at all the gang. And we were like, gang graffiti, what are you talking about? So she couldn't distinguish between, you know, gang scribbling and, you know, full-scale production murals because she's never been exposed to that other side. So it's all the same to her.
You know what it is? It's an art form that comes from a lot of urban neighborhoods, a lot of ghettos, a lot of, you know, there's struggle, there's single-parent families, there's... I'll give you a good example. And for a lot of these kids in these communities, these walls that we're painting are the only form of art that they're introduced to. Because what ends up happening is by the time their parents come home from work, they don't have time to show them to, you know, take them to the MoMA or, you know, introduce them to different galleries, or they don't know what a Monet is, a Goya, a Picasso. So in a sense, sort of like, you know, the Monets and the Goyas that they're looking at are painted on the outside of these grocery stores, on the handball courts where they live, on, you know, the memorial walls we make. These are what brings color to these kids' lives, in a sense.
So. Well, one more question I have, which I find very interesting, is that you have a couple members from Germany, and I know a lot of people come to the Bronx from Europe and other places to really experience real graffiti, real hip-hop music.
Right.
Can you kind of just explain the influence it's had, like, around the world, like other muralists you've worked with and other places you've been where there's graffiti murals?
I mean, we've been painting 20 years, so pretty much, you know, we're well-known in the graffiti movement. So what's happened over the several years is it's become a worldwide movement. It's, you know, Australia, Germany, Japan, Mexico, wherever you want. You know, Paris, I mean, we've gone to Ireland, we've gone Paris, Germany,
Scotland,
London.
England.
We've traveled the world painting graffiti. And in every city, in every country we've been, there's like hundreds of young people that, you know, practice graffiti. So it's become an international movement. You know, there are times where we come to our office and we have like four or five different people, two guys from Spain, a guy from Japan, and a guy from Germany.
Our office looks like the UN of graffiti all of a sudden.
And the thing is, nobody understands
what they're saying.
But the common thread that, you know, brings them together is the art form itself. They'll just sit there for hours and look at pictures of each other's work.
Is that how they get influenced? Like, they've seen pictures of, like, Bronx stuff, and they go back and they use that style there?
Because what ended up happening was in the 80s, there were movies like Beach Street and Wild Style and stuff like that, which were influential movies that didn't make a big movement here in the States, but once they got overseas, kids in Australia, in Japan, in England, they were watching these movies and were moved by, you know, the images they saw that were coming out of the South Bronx. So, you know, they sort of wanted to emulate the same thing. And what ended up happening is with the invention of the internet, it's sort of, I mean, just not too long ago, we had an email from a kid saying, you know, I followed you guys for years. You guys, you know, do great work, yada, yada. And you look at the bottom, and he's writing from Medellin, Colombia. So, you know, you're sort of shocked, you know, by how many people, this art form reaches out to. And one of the saddest things is that this art form was, you know, born and bred in the Bronx and in New York City, but it's given space and, you know, given space to be practiced in places like in Paris, in certain parts of France, in England. There's certain legal locations where you can go, and it's, you know, they give these kids, you know, sort of like certain square footage, you know, and they can use that for a certain amount of time. And someone, you know, one of the local businesses has a map and says, well, we'll give you number 23 for this month. You know, so that's the way they're able to control, you know, what the kids go out and do, because they're given a place where they're respected, you know, where they can do what they want to do.
Okay, well, thanks. Does anyone have any questions for any of the artists here at all?
I mean, a large percentage of them all started. I mean, you got guys in New York City that are close to 40 years old that have been painting for like 30, 35 years, and that's how they got their start. I mean, a lot of the kids, you know, still live this situation, but it's changed now. I mean, it's become, I wouldn't say mainstream, but it's become so popular that you got people from all economic backgrounds, races, and religions practicing graffiti. You know, you got, you know, rich kids whose fathers and you know, mothers are movie directors or CEOs of like brokerage firms painting graffiti alongside with a guy who's single parent family. Percentage wise,
it's kind of hard to say because then again,
I would say more than that. I would say at least 60-70%.
But they want to get uneven.
A lot of these kids go out there and write on stuff just because to rebel. I mean, a teenager is just a teenage phase, so they go out there, they rebel.
Is it rebellion or also just express? It's some a way to express your creativity. I mean, it's a way to just express. Sometimes it's just a way to expression, form of expression as well. So.
No. Keith Haring was never really considered like, you know, a graffiti, even though he was labeled like a graffiti artist by the media. All the real graffiti artists of that time knew he wasn't, and he himself knew he wasn't, but, you know, he hung out with other graffiti artists who did paint on subways, and he basically just did like chalk drawings on, you know, the subway stations. A lot of these guys, you know, that painted trains were like, he's not really one of the risk takers. He's not in, you know, in the yard walking across third rails. He's not, you know, climbing over fences, and so he was never really considered like a graffiti artist. Oh, I'm sorry. Well, what do they paint? They paint their names mostly. Oh, what? They'll find, you know, under railroad tracks, abandoned alleys.
Now, you know what ends up happening? No. No, one of the things that we're trying to do, we teach free classes twice a month at a community center. And one of the things that we stress to these kids is, you know, why fight against, you know, the owners of these buildings? Why go out and do the stuff illegally? I've been through that. I've gotten in trouble. You know, I've gone through a lot of, you know, ups and downs in my life because of that, because I believed in my art form. But one of the things I express to these kids is that if you want to make things a little easier for yourself, you know, go approach the store owners, approach the landlords. You know, you'll find that 8 times out of 10, you know, the person will give you space to paint on because it's not paint out of their pocket that they have to clean the wall with. So if they give the, you know, the kids an opportunity to paint a mural, if they approve the sketch and, you know, it's okay and they work collaborative, then, you know, it's an all-win situation. The kid gets to let out a little, you know, artwork and a little frustration, and he gets to show his work, you know, and practice his skill. At the same time, the store owner is cleaning up his property and has something colorful and nice to show for it. So, you know, there's...
I'm sorry, she had a question. Graf- graffiti art isn't supported by anyone. I mean, a lot of time when we, I'll tell you, now we're able to buy paint. I mean, when we were younger, you know, it's not something we're proud of, but we would go and steal most of our supplies. You know, we had no money, so we would go and steal markers, pencils, you know, spray cans, and that's generally how we were able to do this art form. Nowadays, what we do is we teach classes twice a month where we provide all the materials, the classes are free, and we pretty much fund all the supplies from our pocket, you know, just to enable these kids to have a place to come, express themselves, and they're being told what they're doing is not bad. You know, we sort of nurture them as artists.
Being accepted.
I didn't volunteer it, but I wasn't given a choice. But I understood.
No, but
I was angry, but I understood the motive behind what
actually
he was doing. So I had to laugh it off. I mean, I was
No, but what we would volunteer to these kids, which we do, is we have about 45 locations throughout New York City that we rent out to record companies, ad agencies, different clothing companies. And through our company, we paint advertisements that are in grassroots. They're in these communities, as opposed to a company like Seaboard or, you know, an outdoor advertisement company that would slap a billboard in 20 minutes and leave. You know, we would create a mural project where, you know, we're doing an ad for a company, there's tables that are set out, we have permits, and, you know, they're giving free stuff away. So it's sort of like a, you know, these promotional campaigns that we do. But since we own these locations and we rent them out yearly through these landlords, sometimes when we're not doing anything with these spaces, we let, you know, friends or kids paint on them, you know, as long as they understand that these are locations that we own.
They're walls.
But they're walls in communities where there's actually people living. It's not alleyways. They're not, you know, they're part of their fixtures in communities.
Chicago? I mean, we've been in Chicago. Actually, there are a lot of talented artists in Chicago that we know. There's actually one guy named Design who we know who's a graffiti artist in Chicago, and he's very successful. He's done, I mean, hundreds of gallery shows around the world. He's painted, like, backdrops for great adventures, amusement parks. You know, he's a well-known artist. And I've met a lot of other artists from Chicago who are talented. Oh, our program, I don't know if it exists in Chicago. I mean, this is just something that we've, again, stumbled upon.
We just did something not so long ago in Minneapolis. And what we ended up doing there was they had a problem with some kids in a neighboring projects. And so what they did was they created a class where they had the truant kids and the A students and all get together. And we met with them and explained to them what a process of a mural is. And, you know, so we sort of, we created an idea, visual, you know, a verbal discussion on what we wanted to paint visually. And then we gave all the kids materials. They drew out different ideas of what was going to go on the wall. And then we took the stuff back and created sort of a collage. And then we started to, you know, paint the wall with these kids where they painted it with actual paintbrushes. And then we went back and fine-tuned it with spray paint so that when the unveiling went on, you know, the kids seen a final project. And, you know, when we left the city, there was a sense of pride for them because they can go back and visit it throughout the next few years with friends and say, you know, I took part in this, and look, I did this, and, you know, this is mine. And so, you know, that was so successful that, you know, we created that project with someone that was local over there. That, you know, we have sort of an understanding of what went on, that, you know, we're willing to do something like that in other cities. So, I mean, if you want, before you leave, you can stop by our little booth and I'll give you the information where to reach us. Oh, yeah, Diego and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, actually, we were fortunate enough to visit.
No, we were there. Actually, it's the funniest thing. We were taking pictures of Diego paintings. And
in the presidential palace, we were about to
we were
arrested.
Running from the security guards because they were like, no pictures, no pictures. We're like, okay. So we're walking out, and one of us, like, runs off to the side, takes pictures, and they're running. And it's all for, you know, the love of murals, but it was the funniest thing.
Right.
Right. You know, yeah. right? Yeah. That's come a long way. I mean, if you would have told me 20 years ago that you can design some graffiti on a computer and print it out and paint it on a wall, I would have said you're nuts. You know what I mean? But I'm doing it every day. Graffiti's gone through an evolution, and it's continued. You know, it's continuing to evolve. So, I mean, we just finished doing some projects, and we paint a lot of stuff that people aren't aware we're the ones responsible for. We've done a children's ward for AIDS in the Metropolitan Hospital. We're currently doing St. Barnabas Hospital children's ward in collaboration with the Bronx Zoo, if they ever give us the final artwork.
Yeah, part of the reason we do what we're doing and got started a graffiti company was what we noticed that a lot of these bigger companies were trying to design like graffiti style ads and trying to market to a young audience, but they were using commercial or graphic artists who knew nothing about the art form. So even though they would try to do a graffiti style, when you looked at it, it looked so fake. You could tell, you know, a lot of these people knew it was fake. So we decided to position ourselves like if they're going to be using this art form, then at least they should be using actual practitioners of this art form. Right. You know, if anyone deserves to make money from it, then it should be the ones who live this.
I'm sorry. We do have to stop because there's something else coming up at 3:30. But if you have any other questions, Tats Crew is working on another mural right over here, and they have photos of their work. You can talk to them and ask them questions. And the Ingways are on the other side of the New York section, and you can probably see the neon from here, actually, and you can go and get some demonstrations and talk to them about the process of how they make the glass. Thank you.
Days, but has had unsuspected, you know, skyrocketing success ever since they were first formed.
All right, let's
go. Okay, Roberta Jones and the Boom Booms.
All right, watch Roz for the beat.
Mama, mama, won't you tell me a story? Tell it to me now.
Boom, 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 boom.
Mama, mama, won't you tell me a story? Hand the story down.
Boom, 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 boom.
Papa, papa, won't you tell me a story? Tell it to me now.
Boom, 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 boom.
Papa, papa, won't you tell me a story? Pass the story around.
Everybody.
Pass the story around.
Everybody.
Pass the story around.
Everybody.
Mama, mama, won't you tell me a story? Tell it to me now.
Boom, 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 boom.
Mama, mama, won't you tell me a story? Hand the story down.
Boom, 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 boom.
Papa, papa, won't you tell me a story? Tell it to me now.
Boom, 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 boom.
Papa, papa, won't you tell me a story?
Pass the story around.
Pass the story around.
Everybody.
Pass the story
around.
Pass the story. Pass the story around.
Pass the story. Pass the story.
Roberta Jones!
Hey, Roberta Jones! America! The world will... America! I have to do it in Yiddish, I'm sorry. America! Was hat der größten Schem? America! Hurra für Onkel Sam, America! Kein Bester, es ist nicht du. Hurra, hurra für heute in Weiß und Blue. Now I want everybody to sing it with me. America, your fame the world will span. America, hurra for... Hurra for who? America, hurrah for Uncle Sam. America, no better, it is true. Hurrah, hurrah for what? For what? No, for red and... Red and white and blue. That's right. I was a little girl when I came here. I was 7 years old, and I came from Russia.
I came from a little village in Russia. And when I came, I did not know one single word of English. When I was in Russia, the people tried to tell me that in America, you have to go and you have to learn some English. And they said, in America, you don't say yo, you say yes. In America, you don't say nein, you say no. And in America, for everything else, you say okay. Now, I would like everyone to say okay. That's right. So that when anyone asked me anything, they said, how do you like America? And I said, okay. I had a lot of trouble because I didn't know anything. And I always wanted to go back home because it was not friendly here for me. And I had a lot of trouble with the children because I couldn't speak to them. Well, my father thought he should teach me English because I really had to get along better. And so my father didn't know any English himself. Even though he came here way before I did, he came here 6 years before I did. But he was among the Yiddish people, and he only spoke Yiddish, and he really didn't know English. But he used to love to listen to all the songs on the radio. He loved the music. He loved the American music. And so he listened to the songs, and he learned all the words to the songs. And I want to tell you, he didn't even understand what he was singing. So then when he tried to teach me how to be an American, the first song he taught me was a song that was very popular, but he sang it like this. Mein body lays over the ocean. Mein body lays over the sea. Mein body lays over the ocean. Oi, bring back mein body to me. Well, it took me so many years to find out that it wasn't really his body that laid over the ocean. And then he taught me some other songs like, All Alone by the Telephone. I never could pronounce anything the right way because my father didn't teach it to me the right way. Well, I had a very hard time, a very, very hard time, and it was very bad when I was little. Because it was the Depression, and people didn't have any money. And so when I went to school, I went to PS 66 in the Bronx, and I was one of the few children that still spoke Yiddish. And when I had to go to the bathroom, I didn't know how to ask the teacher that I had to go to the bathroom. And so there was one little girl in class who spoke Yiddish, so I asked her, how do you say I have to go to the bathroom? And she told me, and by the time I raised my hand and I tried to make the teacher understand what it is I wanted, I peed in my pants. The teacher did not like me. The teacher thought I was a pain in her side. She was really mean. Her name, I remember her name. Her name was Mrs. Condley. She should only rot in hell. She was awful. She was terrible. One time, she was so angry at me, she pulled me by the hair into the corner. Every week, we were allowed to bring in 5 cents and we would get a container of milk downstairs when we had recess. We had recess downstairs in school in the gym. Every school that was built at that time had a gym downstairs on the first floor, and it had a big, big circle in the middle where the children played in the circle. And it had a little sort of room with a countertop, and that's where they gave out the milk. That's where they gave out these containers of milk for 5 cents. Well, I stood online. My mother said milk is very healthy, and even though she said we can't afford the 5 cents, you will take milk in school. And so I got on the line to get the milk, And as I was standing on the line, I noticed that there was another line alongside of us, and they went into some other place, and when they came out, they not only had a container of milk, but they had a chocolate graham cracker. Now, I had never tasted a chocolate graham cracker. I had never tasted a graham cracker, but imagine a chocolate graham cracker. It looked so delicious, and one little girl decided perhaps she ought to give me a bite because I looked so longingly at this chocolate graham cracker. So she gave me a tiny little bite, and it was the most delicious thing I had ever tasted in my life. So I asked my mother, please, can I have 3 more cents? For 8 cents a week, you get milk and the chocolate graham cracker. Well, my mother said that we couldn't afford the other 3 cents, and anyway, chocolate was not good for your teeth. So she said, you don't need it. But my heart longed for that chocolate graham cracker. So I noticed that nobody was keeping their eye on who goes on what line. And so I decided that perhaps I should go on the line where they serve the chocolate graham cracker with the milk. Well, my heart was beating very quickly, very fast. I was afraid, but I went on that line. I could not resist that chocolate graham cracker. And I went on the line, and I got the milk and the chocolate graham cracker. I was in seventh heaven. Nobody could compare with me eating that chocolate graham cracker. And I did it several times, and no one saw. Then one day, Mrs. Condorly noticed that I was on the wrong line. She blew her whistle, and everybody, the whole second grade, stopped and looked at Mrs. Condorly. And no, not Mrs., her name was Miss Condorly. And Miss Condorly took me by the scruff of my neck and pulled me into that big round circle and said, children, I want you all to see a thief. This child is a thief. I didn't know what a thief was. I didn't know what she was saying, but I knew it was not good. And I stood there shaking with fright and all the children looking at me, and I couldn't stand it. It was in the fall, the late fall. It was cold outside, but I didn't care. I turned on my heels and I ran out of the school, and I refused to go back to school. And they had a very hard time to make me go back. But I had Mrs. Condorly again, and I have never forgotten Mrs. Condorly. And what I wish for her, I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy. Well, that wasn't my only misadventure. Another thing, I came from a little village. It was a pastoral village. It was like in the country, it had everything, a big meadows and trees and flowers and gardens. And I came to the Bronx. The Bronx had 5-story buildings, one after another. There was no spaces in between. There were no trees. There were no flowers. There were no grass. I was sure that America did not have any grass. Then one day I went around the corner and I saw a little house. It stood all by itself. It had a little garden outside of it, and it was surrounded by grass. And then I saw Angelina walk out of the house. Angelina was in my class. She was one of the kids in my class. And so I decided to make friends with Angelina because I was dying to get into that little garden, just to walk around on the grass, just to touch a leaf. Well, Angelina was sort of friendly, and then I tried to explain to her in my broken English that I wanted to go into the garden. And she said, oh, no, you can't. You can't. My grandmother doesn't let anyone into that garden, especially a Jew. I said, Angelina, please, I'll just go in for a minute. and I'll just run out again. Please let me go into the garden. So Angelina said, okay, I'll let you go into the garden, but you have to run in and you have to run out. And so I ran into the garden, and I just was running along on the different, they had lima beans growing, and they had big, tall flowers like bluebells. And I just touched everything when Angelina's grandmother came out and saw me in the garden. And then she started to scream in Italian. And I didn't understand a word of what she was saying, but I knew it was terrible. And Angelina grabbed me by the hand and pulled me out of the garden. And I said to Angelina, Angelina, what was your grandmother saying? What did she say about me? Why doesn't she like me? Why? And Angelina said, my grandmother said that you're a Christ killer and you have to get out and I can't ever play with you again. And I said to Angelina, I didn't kill anybody. But that didn't matter. I went home crying to my parents. And my father listened to my story. And I said, Papa, I'm not a Christ killer. I never killed anybody, did I? And my father said, no. And then I said, Papa, what is Christ? Who is Christ? And my father said, don't worry about it. Christ is a nice Jewish boy. And that's the end of my story.
I just wanted to tell you another very brief story because Roz's immigrant stories reminded me that there was an Italian immigrant. This is always loved this to learn this, who wanted to come to America because he had heard the streets were paved with gold. And when he arrived here, he discovered three things. Number one, they weren't paved with gold. Number two, they weren't paved at all. And number three, he was the one that was supposed to pave them. So we're celebrating the stories of New York, and we have with us today one of my favorite storytellers in New York. She's part of a group called the Pearls of Wisdom, and she's going to come up and tell you a little bit. She's a Bronx resident. She lived a lot of her life in the Bronx and in Manhattan, and she's going to tell you a little bit about what it was like when she was a little girl. And nobody can make you feel what it was like to be a little kid like Roberta can. She gives you a child's perspective.
I'm going to tell you a story about my growing up. My name is Roberta Jones, and I'm from Hoboken, New Jersey. And in Jersey, we lived at 356 Newark Street. I was born in that building, and I practically raised in that building. And right next door to my building was a candy store where the man sold his merchandise in the front, and he lived in the back. And I can remember my mother going to work, and there was a lady in my building, they called her Fat Sis. Fat Sis used to come downstairs to mind me and my sister. And every morning she'd take us downstairs, and the first thing I did was run into that candy store, and I'd buy my favorite penny candy, which was a thick chocolate Hootin' with nuts and raisins. And at that time for a penny, if you bought licorice, it would last you practically all day. This was during the time of the Depression. Herbert Clark Hoover was your 31st president. I can remember the grown people talking about some people on some Wall Street, how they had lost all their money and they was jumping out the window, killing themselves. Men were working on the WPA. And in order to make ends meet, some people was making bathtub liquor, which they call white lightning. I was a nosy baby. I used to ask my mother so many questions, she'd go to the window. And if she saw Big Sugar sitting on the stoop, she'd tell me to go downstairs and play. I knew everybody in my building. And when I went downstairs to play, the grown people that sat down low, because Big Sugar sat high, I listened to everything they said. I knew who made corn liquor, and I knew who drank it. I knew who was boyfriend and girlfriend. I even knew who went to jail. there was a man in my building, and his name was Skunk. And we little kids called him Mr. Skunk. And he had a girlfriend, and her name was Julia. And because me and my sister liked Julia, we used to call her Aunt Julia. Well, I knew Mr. Skunk drank corn liquor because whenever he was on the stoop, he would talk loud with his hand and drool out the side of his mouth. There was another man in my building, and his name was Solly. And we little kids called him Mr. Solly. Well, one day I told my mother, I said, Mama, every time I go downstairs, Mr. Solly is always looking at me. My mother said, what do you mean looking at you? I say, if I play over here, he looks, and if I play over there, he looks. He's always looking at me. My mother said, Mr. Solly's not looking at you, girl. He's cross-eyed. Oh, but when she said that, she knew she had made a mistake. I said, what do that mean? My mother told me that up in heaven, they were making the baby so fast, they put Mr. Solly's eyes on the wrong side of his head, and the stork came and delivered him to his mother. Well, I said, why didn't his mother take him back? My mother said, because his eyes didn't open for 10 days, and by that time it was too late. Well, I was satisfied with that story. From then on, when I went downstairs to play and Mr. Solly was out there, I'd play on one side and I'd watch his eyes, and I'd play on the other side and I'd watch his eyes. One day, Fat Sis came downstairs to take care of me and my sister, and she looked funny to me. And she come telling me, I want you to be quiet today because I got a headache. Well, I knew she had been in that white lightning. Wasn't no way I was going to be quiet, and I wanted to spend my penny. I got on her nerves so bad she went to the window. I thought she was going to jump out, but she was only looking for Big Sugar. And she told me to go downstairs and stay in front of the stoop until she came downstairs. Down the stairs I went. The first thing I did was run to that candy store. And when you open the door, the bell at the top of the store, door rings loud, and the man come to the front. I give him my penny, and he give me my hootin. And I was so happy to have my hootin, I tore off all the paper. And then I went outside, and I stood with my hootin looking up at Big Sugar with them great big arms and the chin all in her neck and them little beady eyes looking down at me. When I don't know what happened, but that hootin' left my hand and hit the ground. And as I was bending to pick it up, Big Sugar said, don't touch that candy, gal. It's got germs on it. So I told Big Sugar, well, I'm going to pick it up and kiss it up to God, and he's going to clean it. Big Sugar said, I don't care who you're going to kiss it up to. Come here, get this penny, go to the store and buy yourself another piece of candy. So I went up the stairs and I got the penny and I went to the store and I bought me another piece of candy. I don't take the paper off this candy. I go stand by that hootin' I dropped because I figured if somebody come out that house and distract Big Sugar, I'd pick up my candy, kiss it up to God, run in the candy store, let the man wash it off, and I have me two pieces of candy. When all of a sudden, from out of nowhere, here come a skinny old man down the street with some knickers on. And when he got to the stoop, Big Sugar hollered for him. She said, Mister, and he looked up at her. He said, yes. She said, you see that candy over there by that gal's foot? And the man walked over and looked down. He said, yes. She said, kick it in the street. And that man hauled back his leg and kicked that candy so hard his shoe went one way and he went the other, going across the street to get his shoe. When Big Sugar hollered down to me, she said, you know what, gal? But I couldn't answer her because the tears was in my eyes. She said, you shouldn't eat too much of candy because candy make you fat. That night I said to my sister, I said, when Big Sugar and Fat Sis was little, they must have ate a whole lots of candy. And that's just a part of my story. Thank you.
One of the things we'd like to do is see if anybody, any members of the audience have any stories. And I thought I'd bring up, do any of you have any stories that are distinctively about New York? Carl, do you want to come up and tell your story? Anybody who would like to share a story with us about New York? Okay, I'll tell you one of the stories that I love about New York, that I've come to really appreciate about New York. Can we get you to do another one? Okay, I'll tell you this one first. This is the story about a lawyer who got a job in New York for the first time. And as he was leaving his office on his first day of work, he discovered a long fluorescent bulb that was burnt out on the stage. And it was completely off. So he decided that he would find the super and ask the super to change the bulb. So he found the super, and lo and behold, the super refuses to change the bulb, and even though it was burnt out. The super said that there's a different guy that did that floor. So he decided to take out the bulb himself and throw it back in the garbage in the dumpster. So he took out this long bulb, and he goes out, and he's putting it in the dumpster when the super sees him and says, "Nope, nope, nope. You cannot put something that long into a dumpster in New York. When you live in New York, there's a lot of very difficult things you got to deal with." And so he said, "You're going to have to take that with you because you cannot leave it here. The dumpster does not take anything over 6 feet." And this was 8 feet long. So he thought, okay, the hell with it. I'll just take it home with me and I'll throw it out there. So he got on the subway and he was sitting there and he had the pole like this and he was just holding it. And as he was holding it, he noticed that three or four other people started to hold on to that fluorescent bulb also. And all of a sudden he looked out, he saw this whole set of hands holding on to that bulb, and he saw a stop was coming up. And as soon as the subway stopped, he saw the doors open. He had an idea. He just let go, walked off the train, and his problem was solved. We're going to have Roberta tell you one more story.
I'm going to tell you a story about my Nana. When I was 2 years old, my grandmother died, and they took her body south to be buried. When I was 5 years old, I met my grandmother's aunt for the first time. And because that I didn't have no grandmother, I started calling her Nana. And my mother used to take me to Nana's house, and she'd sit me on her high trunk, and she'd tell me stories. My Nana told me that when she was 9 years old, she was smoking a pipe. My Nana told me that she had three husbands and eight children. And because my mother didn't have no sisters and brothers, I started calling her children aunt and uncle. There was Uncle Dan, Uncle Sam, Uncle Harry, Uncle Johnny, and there was Odell. And of the girls, there was Aunt Lean, Aunt Tabe, and Aunt Ollie. And of her husbands, there was Mr. Spimmon, Mr. Pinckney, and Mr. Brown. Nana told me that when she was 12 years old, she was already married to Mr. Spimmon. He worked in the field. She worked in the big house, cooking for the people. But she couldn't eat at their table. And I used to say, "Nana, you should be glad you sit in the kitchen. You eat all you want." My Nana taught me how to make cigarettes. She would go by the side of her dresser and get this machine. And she'd put some newspaper up on top of that trunk. And she'd give me some bugler tobacco and cigarette paper. And I'd make cigarettes. She didn't care how they came out. She didn't care if they was too big or too small. She didn't care if the paper bust. She'd tell me to throw them in the box. They was for my Uncle Harry because he was always begging. My Nana told me that when she first came to New York City, she used to have to stand on the corner of 125th Street, and she'd get a job every time. My Nana told me that she was standing on the corner of 125th Street one day, her and another tall, strapping woman like herself and a little short lady. When this lady passed by and said, "Do you want to work?" And my Nana said, "Sure, I want to work." She said, "You come and go with me, and I want you to come and go with me, too." So that left the little short lady there by herself, and that little lady asked her, "Say, what do you need two people for?" She said, "All I want them to do is pick up a rug." So the little short lady said, "Well, you need three people for that." No, the lady said, "No, I don't. All I need is two." So the little short lady got mad and stomped her foot, and she said, "If I don't get a job today, don't look for your husband to come home for supper." So off they went to this lady's house, and my Nana said when the lady opened the door, it was the beautiful furniture. Everything was so beautiful and big. My Nana said the legs on that lady's piano was bigger than hers. And there was this beautiful throw rug in the floor. And she said, "This is the rug I want you to pick up. Do you think you can do it?" My Nana said, "Sure, we can pick up this rug." My Nana said her and that lady, they worked with every part of their bodies, picking up, hemming with their knees and arms and back. And they finally got that rug rolled up. And the lady gave them some twine. And they tied it and sat it in the corner. And when they got ready to leave, the lady paid them good. Then she said to my Nana, "Do you want this rug?" My Nana said, "Sure, I want this rug." She said, "If you get it out my house by 6 o'clock tonight, you can have it." My Nana said, "I'll send my two sons for this rug." And she told me, "You see this rug you've been playing on? You see this piece here and that piece in the hall? The same rug the lady gave me. Perfectly good rug." Well, when I got a little older, like 10, I wasn't so interested in Nana's stories. The only time I go to Nana's house is when I wanted some biscuits and syrup. And one Friday afternoon, my sister and I went to Nana's house because we knew that Saturday morning she'd get up and she'd make biscuits. But it's one thing about Nana, I got to warn you. Nana would bust out and start singing and scare you to death. And Saturday morning while she was keeling her dough, she said, "Don't you let nobody turn you around.